Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. The program is a project of Action for Healthy Communities and is provided in collaboration with KCBX and the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. And this program is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Fred Monroe is hosting the program from home, of course, today, amid concerns about the spread of the coronavirus. And Fred and his guests will be looking at vital signs, understanding San Luis Obispo County 2020. Join Fred as he speaks with members of the Action for Healthy Communities Steering Committee. Action's recent reports, Vital Signs, provides a pre-COVID-19 baseline examination of community issues for San Luis Obispo County. And Fred and his guests, Jason Wells and Susan Hughes, will examine Action's 8th benchmark study of community issues using data collected immediately prior to COVID-19. You're invited to listen and learn and participate in the conversation today. Call 805-549-8855, or you can email your questions to voices@kcbx.org. And good afternoon, Fred.
Good afternoon, Carol. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for being part of this program. This is Central Coast Voices. Today, I'm joined by members of the Action for Healthy Community Steering Committee. And the word community and committee are too many things in my notes today. Sorry about that. Jason Wells, who is the Associate Director of First Five San Luis Obispo County, is also the current incoming chair of Action for Healthy Communities. He is joining us along with Susan Hughes, who was the founding co-chair of Action for Healthy Communities. And our recollection was that was about 1996. So this has been something we've been examining in San Luis Obispo County for quite some time. Action recently released their latest report, Vital Signs, which was done as a baseline study as for happenstance, was completed just before we got hit by COVID-19. So today what we're really going to do is examine that latest study and look at the history of Action doing these studies, and also get a sense of why this is still relevant material, because one of the comments that we've certainly had among ourselves with this project is that, we did a study just before COVID-19 came to our shores, and why is data that we collected in late 2019 going to be really important as we look at COVID and move forward? Jason and Susan, welcome. Thank you. I appreciate you being with us today.
Thanks, Fred. Good to be here.
I forgot to do one thing that I need to do, and that is remind people, if you haven't followed this, this radio program is actually a production and supported by Action for Healthy Communities. This is the kind of topics we cover on this program are often driven by what we find in the data for both current and previous studies in our community. Susan, let's start out. I guess we probably need to give folks a little bit of history. What in the world is Action, and how did it get to the point where we are now, about 20 years later, still looking at these reports?
Yeah, I can't believe it's been 20 years, but indeed, as I went back to through some of my paperwork, it has been 20 years plus. And basically, Action is an indicator project, and it was originally loosely modeled on the National Movement for Healthy Cities and Healthy Communities. But let me go back just a little further than that. In 1994, the Foundation for Communities Design was begun. And actually, you might recall that Julian Crocker, former superintendent, county superintendent of schools, and Grace Mitchell, former president of Cuesta, they actually brought people together and they called it a visioning project. And they worked for 3 or 4 years on this, and they talked about, they focused on growth and education and public safety, and brought about 4,000 people together overall for over a period of 3 or 4 years. And about the same time, the county public health was under, well, actually, I should say the County Health Commission, which at that point was relatively new, asked Carlin Christensen, who was a member there, to start a task force to look at health data. And so I was in the county at that point, and I got charged with gathering initial data, mainly public health and social service type data. So it was a little bit different than what the Foundation for Community Design was doing. And we had many community members meeting and trying to find out what were the goods, the bad in our community. And then on top of that, there was a group of people led by Jana Nichols of United Way and also Debbie Nicholas from the Community Health Foundation. And they were wanting to bring a larger group of people together to see what the community overall looked like. So we all looked up one day and realized that many of us have been going to all these separate entities and participating in them independently. We said, well, that's kind of crazy. Why don't we get together? And that basically started Action for Healthy Communities. And by bringing everybody together, we blended the management and growth and education indicators and public safety with the health and social service indicators and basic needs and that sort of thing. So we had a broader brush look at what our community was. And really I should give a shout out to Debbie Nicholas, who really was the very first chair for a couple of years. And then since about 2002, I looked up, Jana Nichols and I had co-chaired Action, and she then left me for a while, I think in about 2008 or 9, I don't recall. But anyway, this is our 8th report that we've launched, and just like with anything, when you do a report, you start 2 or 3 years in advance because there's lots of money involved and people who have to support it, and you relook at what is it you want to look at, how's our community maybe changed, has something that we didn't ask 3 or 4 years ago, do we need to ask this time? So it's the report itself is a process, and when this one came out right at post-COVID, I likened it back to the 2010 report that we did. Because we went through that 2008-09 recession, and actually Action didn't publish anything for about four and a half years then. So when the 2010 report came out, we were sort of post the economic recession. And we were able to use, that's a pretty good baseline. We were and percolate up from there. So interestingly enough, it's been about a 10-year perking up with all the data. And here we are again, sort of rolling ourselves going back to, what has COVID done? How will we look forward with this report? So that was a lot of information in a short period of time. But I also want to give a shout out to the Community Foundation, who also has supported us with staffing since almost the beginning, and in particular Janice Wolf, who was with us for many, many years. And now we have Cassandra Wagner, who isn't with us today, but she's giving us as a way to support Action. We're not a nonprofit. We are a collaborative group of members made up of county folks, nonprofit groups, business folks. And that's how we wanted to govern ourselves. We never wanted to become an entity because it was for the good, a collaboration for the entire community.
Yeah. As we've looked at the reports over time, one of the things that has come up, and I realize it's come up in the discussions at the Action Steering Committee, and that is whether or not organizations still find this kind of data collection valid or valuable. And it's a challenge all the time. One of the things I'm sure that the steering committee has to do is decide what kind of questions are relevant now that were not relevant a few years ago, or vice versa. And so it's a challenge all the time. And I'm sure that our listeners are probably wondering why in the world the data gets collected at all and what kind of purpose it serves. And so I think that's probably something that we need to answer, and we need to answer at this point in the discussion.
I can jump in a little bit there, Susan, if you want.
Yeah.
So over the years, certainly we've looked at the data collection and when we do the survey to see what's still relevant and what we need to watch over time. And sometimes there are things that might have been relevant 10 years ago because there was a particular issue happening, a movement perhaps in the county that's no longer happening. And now we want to change out that question and put something new in. So for instance, we have tracked concern about water and water availability, but now we're also tracking concern about wildfires and both wildfires, water availability, and water quality. You can only have a survey that has so many questions. Already when our company ASR that does the survey reaches out, the survey takes about 22 minutes, which is a really long time. If you've ever been called to do a survey, most of us can only stay on the phone. I mean, if we stay on the phone at all, we stay on, you know, maybe less than a couple minutes and we're ready to go. This is a long survey. And so it's also one of the, if not, I think the longest local survey of public opinion. And so, and it's public opinion across a lot of areas. And I think that's really important. You know, we're vital signs. And when you're thinking about vital signs, even as we sort of think of our own personal health, you know, we think about heart rate and we think about weight and we think about muscle and fat and we think about our blood pressure. Well, we look at this and with vital signs kind of similarly. You know, we're not just going to look at one area of health. We're going to try and look at a lot of areas. We're going to look at the built environment. We're going to look at the natural environment. We're going to look at how people are doing socially and emotionally, how their physical health is. We definitely want to look at that. How's their food and housing, their basic needs. So we're going to try and cover a lot of those areas so that when we present this to the community, depending on why you're looking at it, are you an organization that serves families in need? You might look towards one indicator. If you're an organization perhaps that does housing, you might look towards another indicator.
One of the things that I think comes up for a lot of folks is how you can fit the pieces together in such a way that, I mean, this is a long report. I believe the current report's about 70 or 80 pages. Some of the reports in the past have been longer than that. The average person, well, the average nonprofit or government agency that relies on this data may be indeed have the staff and the resources to sit down and scrutinize the entire report. For the members of the public who might find a good portion of this data very valuable, once you hand me something that's 75 pages long, it's like, thank you very much. I guess it's going to prop up a corner of my table. So I think it becomes a factor that we really need to pay attention to, and I'm sure that you have paid attention to, and that is how you can put this data together in such a way that it is in-depth for those people who want to see an in-depth study, but it also gives some snapshots to the general members of the community that that really just want to see where things are for them.
Sure. So I think
Susan, I'll just take a quick one. Yeah. I was just looking at some of my notes, and one of the things from the very first action survey that I have noted as lessons learned was that the first survey wasn't user friendly. And so we focused on how we could solve that. And I think probably every book since then, we've worked on that. And of course, we used to actually publish and print and hand out that 300 page survey, which we obviously don't do anymore. But that, I think, Fred, that is a challenge. And I don't know that we have all the answers. Jason, you want to take it and see?
Well, I was going to say, at the very least, there's at the beginning of the report, there's a project overview and there's an executive summary, which makes it nice. And if you just want to get a quick scan of some of the things that are in there, financial well-being, mental health, public health, employee or physical health, things like, you know, children's screen time, concern about crime and violence. So you can look at that to see if there's an area that interests you. And one of the things, Fred, that I think is great about this report is that, you know, as we've been developing, and I think oftentimes we think about our colleagues, grant writers or managers of programs that are bringing services to the community. But in this day and age, and especially right now when there's so much social justice work and work around Black Lives Matter, and we understand the intersectionality of all of these elements, that people who are community members and community advocates who are social justice advocates who want to see change in their community. Often it's not easy to find local data. And so for those people, I would say, take a look at this report and see how it might inform or help amplify whatever issue you're trying to strengthen and share with the community. Because I think there is data in there that can be helpful for those groups, as well as groups like nonprofits, private industry, the business community, to just really understand the state of our community, or at least the state of our community back in December, and how we might have changed since COVID, and what ways we might want to, what things we're going to have to work on to get back to the good things that were happening in our community before COVID.
Okay. I want to get back and visit the revisit the executive summary and a couple of things in that in a moment. But I want to remind our listeners that if they have any questions they want to pose to you and we want to pose to us about this topic, they can give us a call at 805-549-8855. They can also email us at voices@kcbx.org. I will remind you, if you are sending us an email, if you have complex questions about the topic, we will probably pass it on to the guests if we cannot get to it all and address it in the conversation today. So we'll pass on your email to both Jason and Susan to follow up on. You can also find a copy of the latest report, which I can tell you is a PDF file that's easy to find online, and you can find it at actionslo.org. It is, I think it's about 77 pages and available. And it is a comfortable read. It's not in 4-point type that will make us crazy forever. And you may actually want to look at that while we're talking about it today, because there may be things that come up for you. For both of you, I looked at the executive summary earlier today, and I've looked at other parts of the report, but I tend not to be a detail person from that standpoint in my discussion with you all. But the kind of thing that came up, and my question that was a recurring question as we talked about this topic, and we've looked at action generally, is whether or not doing a report in late 19 is going to give us any information that's going to be helpful. For a lot of people, there was a feeling that the report was out of date about the first time we heard what COVID-19 was. And obviously that's not the case, but that's what a lot of people in the community think about. When I look at things like on the executive summary page, actually it's on page 7, everybody's actually looking at the report. There's a reference to employment, and the question that was asked is, how concerned are you about employment opportunities in your community in 2019? So there, 35.2% of the population was not concerned at all. 37.4% of the population was somewhat concerned, and 27.3% of the population was very concerned. The numbers on that, I think, are not what we need to analyze right now, but we need to probably remember that when we get to the point of being post-COVID and looking at a study at that time, we're probably going to get a far better understanding of what employment ramifications were in our county, having that information, which was collected in the last couple of months of 19. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the kind of balancing act that I think is going to become very valuable, because there's been a lot of general discussion that we have changed the entire world. There will not be our new normal will be a strange normal, but how do we look at what the old normal was? I think having a study like this is very helpful.
I think it is too. You know, Fred, most of us have short memories, and it's easy after now we're going on 8 or so months of COVID to think that the struggles and the stress that we're feeling right now, that we've always had that. And it's sometimes hard to remember for people who are fortunate enough that did have jobs and they did have healthcare and they did have access to childcare and all those kinds of things, that those things were available just a short time ago. Not everybody, certainly not in the community. And there are disparities that we saw pre-COVID. So I think one thing that it's a good marker for how things were, whether it's unemployment or any of the other indicators. You touched on employment, and certainly that's an area that, you know, at least, you know, in the first wave of COVID, as things shut down, unemployment was huge. And so how people felt about employment, we know that that changed dramatically in March and April. And so if we were to do the survey today, I think we'd see dramatically different answers. Thinking about the relevance of this report, and I touched on this a little bit in the beginning, that, and I'll just bring it back around. The things that were challenges before COVID are almost certainly still going to be challenges, and more so after COVID. The things that were working and were doing well pre-COVID, we want to look at and understand why they were doing well so we can get back there. The things that were challenges previously, also we want to take a deeper dive, because with COVID, we know that it's disproportionately affected the Latino community in our county and other areas as well. And even pre-COVID, the challenges that we see in some of the indicators, some of the health indicators, economic indicators, those were disproportionately affecting the Latino communities and people of color before COVID as well. And so when we see, you know, a change where we're not in a COVID time, we're really going to want to take a look there and check into those communities. I mean, not when it's over, but even right now, we need to make sure we are really focusing our efforts in these communities, because we know they were hurting or challenged before, and we know it's probably only worse right now.
Yeah, I'm glad you go ahead, Susan. Yeah.
If I jump in just quick, this may be kind of an odd way to look at it, but as I'm going through the executive summary, you know, we tried to pick out those things that we knew we thought would be affected by COVID, right? Financial well-being, employment, mental health, physical health, and we're hearing that on a national level too. It's not a big surprise. But you know, the other side of that coin is we know where we were in 2019. And it'll be interesting to see if, in effect, will COVID affect all these things as badly as we think they're going to or not? I mean, we're going to have a baseline to tell us that. It could be that some of our projections are not going to come to fruition. You know, it might be that somehow our mental health in Slo County, because we were able to walk outside for longer periods of time due to the weather, did not suffer quite as much as some may have projected otherwise. That sort of thing. It's kind of a different way to look at it.
Yeah, I think you bring up some good points that we may not even be able to find by study. And that is, as you were saying that, it occurred to me that how people deal with strangers, how people deal with their larger community will probably be drastically different. I mean, for some of us, we may still have fear of being too close with someone who might be ill. However, on a daily basis, one of my comments to in my family all the time is, I'm waiting for the day I can just start hugging everybody again, because it's been a missing part of my life, which means there are members of my community that I may not be that fond of all the time, but I'll be just glad to see when we're not still somewhat sheltered in this regard. Jason, you brought up a good point with regard to the Latino community, because I did notice there was kind of a little a side marker on one of the early pages of the study that basically referenced, and I quote, 9% of the Latino Action telephone survey respondents reported going without health care in 2019. So 9% of that population, and that is a population that we have, as you said, we have seen markedly disproportionately affected by COVID. Mm-hmm. A good, as I understand it, and this is not statistically backed up, but just what I've heard, my hearsay from the media, is that a good portion of the population in Paso Robles, because it has had a larger percentage of COVID cases than other parts of the county, has been driven by the fact that a lot of Latino families are squeezed more people into smaller housing environments, which has affected that. So having my hunch is that 2 years from now, we'll be able to look at that statistic of 9% of the Latino community not having health care in 2019 and wonder whether or not we've effectively looked at that, because I'm sure that the economic environment now has not made health care any more accessible. And we had the Affordable Care Act prior to 2019. We'll see whether or not we have it in 2021 or not. That's a politics we probably need to stay out of at the moment. But I think that gives us the kind of information that's going to be very helpful to have in 6 to 18 months.
Absolutely. I think, you know, pre-COVID, you know, we know that healthcare isn't available to all families. If you're undocumented and you're an adult, it's difficult, if impossible, if not impossible, to get healthcare. For children, it's a little bit easier. Also, if you look at, you know, where some of the Latino, Latinx families are, or adults might be employed, whether it's in agriculture or in hotels and other hospitality restaurants, they don't often offer healthcare opportunities anyway. And then you look at, well, if you had a job and you were able to afford and buy your own healthcare before, but you lost your job due to COVID, I mean, the fact that we have healthcare tied to your job, and if you lose your job during a global pandemic and your healthcare goes away, imagine the repercussions that might have on you and your family and what that might feel like. So absolutely, we need to keep an eye on both health coverage and access. Because quite frankly, during the shutdown, a lot of medical offices were closed for a time. And if they weren't closed, families were uncertain about whether or not they were supposed to even go to the doctor. And so we're trying to understand how that's going to look, as certainly you've got community health centers is open, and you've got a lot of doctor's offices throughout the county who are making an effort to say, hey, we're open and we're ready to see you, because we know you may have held off coming in at either out of uncertainty or fear, but we want to see you now. And so we need to make sure that the people who weren't seen the last 8 months for whatever their health issue is, that they're seen in the coming months and that they're getting the healthcare that they need, whether or not it's COVID related or not.
Yeah, I think that's going to come into play more, because I believe more doctor's offices to this day are doing appointments. They're doing teleconferencing, if you will, for medical appointments.
Sure.
I'm not sure. My cardiologist may not be happy with the kind of information I give him about my blood pressure if I took it myself, as opposed to relying on his staff, which he trusts to be less of a liar about it than I am. I think those things are going to come into play. And I'm somewhat flipping my comment. I apologize for that. But I think it becomes a factor we have to look at. Not only are people maybe not getting the health care they need from a financial standpoint, but the protection of the medical community has become so critical that it may take a long time to recover from that part of the equation also. We're going to take a break. Go ahead, Susan.
Yeah. I just interject quickly. This leads me to believe, I know Jason's looking at all this data. I know that he is an associate program person at First Five. And my challenge to Jason would be, so Jason, tell us how you use that data in order to mitigate some of these, you know, future challenges that you see.
Okay. Jason, we're going to take a quick break, do a little station ID, and we'll be right back. And I'll let you answer after the break, which should give you about 45 seconds more to think about it. This is Central Coast Voices, and we'll be back with you in just a moment.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Central Coast Voices. And as Fred said, we will be right back. You're listening to Central Coast Voices with host Fred Munro on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. And you are invited to be a part of today's discussion. To bring your comments or questions to today's guest, you can call at 805-549-8855 or email to voice@kcbx.org. Back to you, Fred.
Okay, thanks, Carol. That break was primarily given Jason a chance to answer the tough question from Susan that she asked before the break. So I appreciate that, Jason. Susan, why don't you rephrase the question again, and we'll go from there.
I will try to do my best. I was just wanting Jason to help us understand how the report might be used in what he does every day at First Five to mitigate some of these future challenges that you're all talking about.
Yeah. So the agency that I work for is First Five San Luis Obispo County. And our role, our mission is to serve children ages 0 to 5, their families with children ages 0 to 5. And one of the things in this report that we see that was quite frankly not a surprise to us is that childcare remains a challenge for families, that mental health supports remain not a challenge, but a need for families. And so with childcare, for instance, and especially with COVID, childcare was really impacted because a lot of them had to shut down. They've had to institute pretty careful health and safety protocols to help families feel and children to help families remain and stay safe and feel safe as well. So we use that. We had just finished our strategic plan right as COVID was hitting. But using the data that's in Vital Signs, where we still see that these things are a challenge, we released First Five is largely a funder of other programs in the community. And so we were able to release some funds into the community and ask some of the community service providers to respond with ideas to how they could create more childcare access for families, both whether it's on the family end of the support or for programs. Because quite frankly, with childcare right now, a lot of the providers are just barely hanging on. They've had to, a little bit like restaurants, they've had to reduce the amount of children they can have in the space at one time. And some families haven't felt safe enough to bring them back, to bring their kids back. And so we recently just completed a grant where we're giving the Childcare Resource Connection through CAPSLO funding that they can offer childcare providers health and safety stipends, which is really important right now. They're spending a lot of money making sure that their operations are healthy and safe. And that comes out of their pocket. They're not getting any more money. You know, childcare providers in general are not making a lot of money to begin with. And so offering from between $500 and $600 up to $1,000 as a stipend might help two things. It helps them provide the health and safety they need to for the children they're attending, but it also gives them just a little tiny bit of a cushion to make it to the next month. And so we felt that was important. Another way is that we've responded is we know that there's so much uncertainty with COVID and there's so much stress, and especially if you're a new parent or you're an expectant parent. So we have been able to put resources out into the community that are just beginning right now to provide perinatal mental health support in by way of counseling, more counseling and support services for families and both bilingual and or English and Spanish. And these will be free of charge and available virtually or by Zoom so that families throughout the county would have access. And that's something that First Five has done in the past, but it was only in certain areas. So if I can turn some of the challenges of COVID on their head a little bit, We spoke a little bit about the telemedicine and how that's changing how we're all doing business. Well, in some ways, it allows services that were restricted to small regional areas previously, we can now, we don't have that restriction now. We can say we have counseling services available countywide for families that may be feeling, families with children 0 to 5, who may be feeling challenged and stressed because of everything that's going on. I mean, families generally with new kids or young kids can feel challenged, and now with COVID, it's even more so. So those are a couple examples of ways that we're trying to respond using both the data that's in Vital Signs, the data that's available to us through Child Care Resource Connection. And then, like a lot of programs, most programs who are trying to serve the public right now, we're trying to understand what's happening right now and what might be happening, say, a month from now, which is not easy because the COVID changes and makes everything a little more uncertain. So we're shortening some of our grant periods where we think that maybe we don't know what things are going to look like in July of next year. And in other ways, we're thinking something like a mental health services, some of these programs, we're saying, we know this is going to be an issue for families for a little while. So we're leaving those contracts in place for up to 18 months.
And so again, if I could just get back to like what my viewpoint is, that this book is a pre-pandemic baseline for the quality of life in San Luis Obispo County. And it not only helps people like Jason, but it helps the county government, the people in county government. The Board of Supervisors looks at the report as they do their performance-based measurements. Every county department is caused to make outcomes and goals and they just don't do programming willy-nilly anymore, or pet projects in nonprofits don't happen. Our goal and our hope is that people will use this report to guide them and to look at trends and emerging issues and all of that. And so this baseline opportunity is something that, even though when we first thought, when we got the report back, we went, oh boy, why did we do it? When you really think it through, we think it's going to be very, very valuable.
Yeah. Both today and going back 20 years when this project, 20 plus years when this project started, is there any place else you could get regional data? I mean, we you know, there's statewide markers for healthcare, for employment, for child care, for education. But my hunch is you couldn't get it that looked at even the Central Coast, but in this case, San Luis Obispo County. So where else was this kind of data available prior to doing a report like this, Susan?
Well, you're right, Fred, not many places. I mean, the state did collect some public health data, like way back in the AIDS crisis, they had to report AIDS cases and HIV cases. Smoking was a big one for them. So public health had always been sort of involved in that sort of thing. But other places, other parts of government, like planning and transportation and all that, it was very, very hard. And then again, getting it, there were some Central Coast, we'd be lumped together with Santa Barbara, Monterey sometimes, or Santa Barbara, Ventura, which we know those counties are very, very different. So this is and has been the only telephone survey. It was statistically significant. And it's the only one done. I think we were almost one of the first ones in the state of California to do it. So, you know, over time, there's always been secondary data that is a good complement to this telephone survey. But one reason we made it bigger and called more people in that second and third surveys was so then we could actually regionally break down the data from South County. And I live there, so I know I'm very different. My neighborhood is very different than Fred's neighborhood where he lives up in North County. You know, so that's unique, and the data is the only data like it, really. It has to be married with other things like secondary data that we know exist, like even observations that Jason talks about in his work. You know, he knows what his nonprofit funded folks are telling him, and the county government departments have, you know, ways to know the customers they serve. But there's still this piece that gives the whole quality of life indicators, from health to economy to education to, and I think Jason was talking about, how does the built environment affect health? So it gives opportunities for us to look at this whole big, not just little silos, but the big picture in the county of what if this happens, how does that affect that or this quality of life?
Okay. Well, a question I will pose to either or both of you. Having now looked at the data, have you seen any surprises in this report that you weren't aware of were factors? And have you seen anything that is a surprise that, gee, having this data when we ask these questions, we didn't realize how important that's going to be to looking at a post-COVID world, because you decided on the questions you were asking before we knew COVID even existed?
Yeah, Fred, I'll take a stab at that. I'll be careful. I'm not sure if it's a surprise, but I think it's important. And you have to dig a little bit into the report and a little bit into the data. Is some of the disparity between the white respondents and Latinx and people of color. I'll say generally across the board, white respondents respond to the questions more favorably, or say they're doing better than do Latinos and people of color. When we talk about, and especially I'll kind of bring it around to, you know, we've had months and months now of social justice and Black Lives Matter in the news and in our community, and trying to understand how we are impacted by institutional racism in our county. This is in our data right now, that if you ask people of color if they were concerned about racism, about 59% said yes, they were concerned. They were somewhat or very concerned. If you ask white people if they were concerned about racism, it's about 52%. So it's not a huge difference, but there's a difference there. If you ask white people how they would rate law enforcement as very good or good, about 83% say yes, very good or good. If you ask people of color about law enforcement and how they feel about it, about 72% say they feel that they're doing good or very good. And as a committee, action is not here. We're not here to speculate, to say we know the reason why that is. But I think it's okay for action to point out that those disparities exist. Across the board, if you look at Latino health rates, or respondents who said they report their health as fair or poor, it's about twice as much as white respondents report fair or poor. And conversely, the number of white folks who are respondents who say, you know, their health is good or great is roughly about twice as many as our Latino and people of color. So there is a disparity that's happening in our community that was happening prior to COVID. Certainly the strong movement around social justice and around racial equality that has come out since this report, I think reflects some of what we see in the data here. And I hope that community advocates, that policymakers, community leaders who are involved in these areas can take a deeper dive into the data and see how it can inform the work that they do. Because that's, as Susan and I have talked about before, and Susan, you may want to comment, that's not our role to say this is what should be done because of this data, but it certainly jumps out for those of us who are aware enough and taking a deep dive and looking at it.
My hunch is also that doing a study like this allows you to look at data that's not anecdotal. If you talk to one client that walks in the door of your agency about how they feel about their healthcare, that one person may give you a different answer today than they give you tomorrow. And depending on how they're feeling, or maybe their frustration that a prescription that they needed to buy was more expensive than they thought it was going to be. So their negative feeling today may be different. So getting a broader picture helps us, I'm assuming, helps you remove some of that anecdotal type of thing that often gets in the way when you're doing individual interviews. Because I'm assuming that the steering committee was not sitting in on phone interviews. You were basically getting data from a data company after this was collected. I should say with it, a data company I believe you've been using for many, many years successfully. So it's not like that's changed. But I guess trending becomes easier to spot with a large group of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Do you want to say anything about that, Susan?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that was one of the things we had when we began action. We had many, many groups trying to collect data all individually. United Way was collecting data. EOC, now Capsule, was collecting data. The county was collecting data. But it was always a little bit in their own little silos. And so we understood the need for a broader brush of random sample, statistically significant questions that, and when you say the data group who's helped us for many, many years, they are professionals. This is what they do. And they do other community surveys as well. So they lend their expertise to our needs as far as how do we ask these questions, or how do, you know, we may ask a question, but they're going, no, you don't want to answer it that way or ask it that way, because you're not going to get an unbiased answer. So they've guided us along the years in how to even ask questions. And certainly once that, and Jason was on the committee most recently, but once the questions are set, then they go off to ASR, and we don't see them until they come back and tell us we have too many questions and the survey's too long. But it's in their ballpark, and like I said, done in a very professional fashion. In fact, I think I've been told that by someone recently that got a call, how well the questions were asked and performed. And so Jason, go ahead if you had something else to say. I'm sort of my end here.
Sure. No, that's okay. I think that one thing, Fred, is that just like if you were to ask me how I'm doing at 8 o'clock in the morning versus how I'm doing at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I might give you different answers. It varies, but that much for all of us individually. This is a point in time survey that we did in December of 2019, or it was completed by December 2019. And as Susan mentioned, we don't think this is the end all be all, that this is the only report and data you need to inform the work and the policy decision-making that you do. We think it's an important point in time survey that reflects what was happening at that time. And it's important to look at other data. I might insert here that not to steer people, I think people should actually obviously go to actionslow.org, but slowhealthcounts.org is another area that we didn't used to have a website, where the public health department, Claire Herman at Public Health, has collated a lot of data, to secondary data, to be able to look at and understand along with our vital signs report.
Yeah. I want to remind people, because I think this may come up sometimes in the discussions. If you go to actionslo.org to look at the report, archived there are all the older reports also. And there is absolutely no charge to acquire any of that. I believe they're all in PDF form, so they can be downloaded by anyone who has a computer that does PDF, which is pretty much anybody. And I'd encourage people to do that and take a look at them, even if it's just out of curiosity.
And they're actually,
Susan, you had some.
Yeah, they're actually, the full reports are PDF, and we've even made it so simple for everyone. If you just want to look at basic needs, you can click on and look at basic needs and download that. In addition to a group of what we called folios that we did for several years, that really we took the data out of the book and did the status of children in Slo County. We did housing in Slo County. We did, I can't remember the others, but we really took, we focused on the data from the report and gathered a whole lot more data from people in the know in the county and did these smaller folios in that effort to make it more user-friendly. But yeah, I actually was on the website this morning, and I clicked on the 1999 report and went, oh, there we are. I mean, I'd forgotten what it looked like and how we did it. And I mean, it is a service that Action provides, and hopefully if anybody would like to learn a little bit about their community, I think it's an excellent research tool.
Yeah. Good segue. As most of my regular listeners know, I talk too much during the program, so I spend some time in the last little bits of the program staying out of the way. Susan, I'll start with you since you have the historical background. What do you want to make sure people remember about this report and this discussion?
Well, I want everybody to understand that we all should be pretty proud. We have this report. As I said, we were one of the first counties in the state to implement this. It took thousands of people coming together in the late 90s, and then lots of people working on the steering committee ever since to keep generating not only the interest in data and performance-driven data, but also this is not a cheap report. So we have many, many sponsors that we need to thank. And Fred, I'm going to take just a minute to say the County of San Luis Obispo is one of our major sponsors and we couldn't do this without the Board of Supervisors' support and the Department of Public Health. Dignity Health has been on board for as long as I can remember. CAPSLO has been, and Biz Steinberg is still on our committee, our steering committee. So thanks to both of them. First Five San Luis Obispo County, SLOCOG, or the San Luis Council of Governments. Tenet Health has always been very supportive, as, again, the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo providing staff support for the steering committee. Transitions Mental Health is a member. Must Charities is a newer member, and we were delighted to have them because they have a whole different focus from some of the more governmental agencies. United Way has stayed with us, San Luis Obispo County Housing Trust Fund. I mean, the report is I don't remember, $75,000 this year, and it was it was a little smaller form. So it has cost in the past up to $100,000. I also want to say Voices came about because of the report, really, and a way for us to disseminate some of the information out of there. And Joan Sargent has been a shining star in that for us. We really appreciate her support specific to the Voices program.
Okay.
So that's my
Jason.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Jason, as the new chair of Action, you get the last word.
Thanks, Fred. So I think that with the report, there's a lot in there pre-COVID that we have. You know, San Luis Obispo, you always hear like, oh, we're the happiest place in the country, and I think those of us who kind of work in the trenches understand that that's a bit of a mythology, and there are a lot of great things about our community, and some of that's reflected in the report. I think though that part of the role of Action and Vital Signs is to amplify and to share and highlight those areas that we still are challenged by and can do work with. And I want to highlight just one area, and I've touched on it a little bit. There is a question in the survey that says, in the past 30 days, have you gone without food, childcare, or health care? And if you look at the data, the number of families that said, yes, I've gone without food, childcare, or healthcare in the past 30 days is double in Latino families than it is white families. And I'm not saying I understand why all that is happening. I have some ideas, they'd be speculating, but I suspect there are community programs and advocates, Promotoras and CAPSLO and others, and the UNDOCU support team, a lot of groups who are working to serve these families might understand that more. But I think it's important that we don't lose sight of that, that there are areas that we were challenged for before COVID, and we're going to be even more challenged afterwards. And so it's up to us to sort of rise up and keep looking at those areas that are a little harder to find and fix, but make sure that we stay on it.
Great. Thank you. This has been Central Coast Voices. I appreciate you joining us today. Jason, you gave me an interesting lead-in because Chris Kington Barker is going to be speaking next week with people working on the collaborative efforts of SLO County Undocumented Support. They will discuss how a coalition of local organizations and community leaders are concerned about individuals who are undocumented and their significance and place in the community, especially under the issues of looking at COVID right now. That'll be part of a discussion because those people are taxpayers, even though they are undocumented workers in many cases. And the Undocu Support Project in San Luis Obispo County is Chris Kington Barker's focus on the program next week. I thank you very much, Jason, for bringing that up. You gave me a good lead into that.
Welcome.
You may not have known. Anyway, and now I get this. This is going to sound like old hat, especially for today. Central Coast Voices is a production of Action for Healthy Communities, a project of the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County, along with KCBX. We've told you many times how you can find the report at actionslo.org. You can also email us at voices@kcbx.org with any feedback you have. Thank you to KCBX, listener-supported public radio, our engineer Carol Tangeman in the studio today, and Jason Wells and Susan Hughes as our guests here. This has been Central Coast Voices. We'll join you next week.